morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with David Colson, who's a photographer and the author of a wonderful book called African Rock Art. And we're also going to be hearing a commentary from Ron Bloomberg, because it is Tuesday. Right now, I'd like to welcome Pete McCormick. He is writer and co-director of the film Uganda Rising. It's an award-winning documentary that screens tomorrow night, Wednesday, at the Santa Fe Film Center, formerly known as the Cinema Cafe. Welcome, Pete, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Now, you've made a film about Uganda that opens up a universe that probably most of us know nothing about or very little about. How did you find yourself making this film?
It was a very interesting, same way as everybody, as you just described, people not knowing what's going on there. I didn't know a lot about Uganda. I knew some about it because I have an interest in history and an interest in African history. But this footage sort of came to Jesse, the co-director, and I, Jesse Miller, and what was going on in Uganda, and we from a group of shooters who had been there shooting, and we had to put it together, and we were sort of given the task of figuring out what's going on here, and we realized as soon as we started looking at it more and more that it was not just a northern Ugandan story, or a Ugandan story, or even a story of the Great Lakes region of East Africa. It ended up being not only an African story, but even a world story, given colonialism and given 9/11 and given all kinds of things about the troubles that these people, the Acholi people of northern Uganda, were going through. And so we traveled to the UN and traveled to New York and interviewed many people from Uganda and many wonderful people and put together this story, this long story.
Right, right.
What's going on there?
Well, if you can summarize it briefly, what is the nature of the current conflict in Uganda that the film is talking about?
Well, there's been a 20-year conflict since 1986 between a rebel group known as the Lord's Resistance Army that are quite well known now in the news, but were considered the most neglected news, humanitarian disaster in the world, and perhaps still are. But called the Lord's Resistance Army, this rebel group who had been abducting children for about 20 years and forcing them into their army to fight against the Ugandan military and the government of Uganda, who was led by Yoweri Museveni, and the Acholi people whose kids were being abducted were actually caught in between the two groups and have been for 20 years, a very difficult 20 years. 10 of those years they've been put into camps by the government, ostensibly to protect them, and that hasn't been protecting them at all. And through different myriad stages of many stages of peace talks and so on, and in the last 20 years, some say about 1.5 and 2 million people have been put into camps and displaced. The Acholi people, 25,000 or even more, some say 30,000 children have been abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army, and it's just been an ongoing sort of brutality.
It's an irony that is unfortunately all too familiar, is that it's called the Lord's Resistance Army. This actually has spiritual or mystical roots?
Yeah, it does indeed. Its predecessor was a woman named Alice Laquena, actually, and of the Holy Spirit movement. And she was in this 1985, 86, after the Civil War in Uganda. There's always been a traditional divide between the north and the south of Uganda, the north being a different language called Nilotic speakers, and the south being Bantu speakers, and this was exacerbated by the by colonialism intentionally, and then after the Civil War, a sort of a southern president was came to power, and the northern soldiers who had fought for the previous president Milton Obote, who was a northerner, fled north, and groups started to fight against Museveni from the north, and led by Alice Laquena, this woman called the Holy Spirit Movement, and she actually won some major battles against the army, strangely, because so supposedly they would come charging with, singing hymns and carrying AK-47s and spears and so on. They were eventually sort of demolished in October of 1986, I think, and the next group that arose from that were called the Lord's Resistance Army, led by this Joseph Coyne, who is actually indicted by the ICC now for war crimes, Crimes Against Humanity. But yes, he actually supposedly even channeled one of her spirits, and he wanted to instill or bring in a government based on the his version of the Ten Commandments. And it's always been sort of this blend of his indigenous religion, obviously twisted, and the Christian religion, obviously twisted too, in a sort of a mix-up. It's almost like a post-colonial mix-up. It's very difficult to answer why it's so twisted like that. But those are the roots of it, anyway.
We're talking to Pete McCormick, and the film is called Uganda Rising. It opens tomorrow night. It screens only one night, unfortunately, here in Santa Fe, but that's tomorrow night at 7:45 at the Film Center. Somebody makes a statement in the film, when two elephants fight, the one who gets hurt most is the grass, and the grass in this case is, the children.
Yeah, it really is. And it's a wonderful saying, actually, because it can actually apply out of Africa as well, as we all know, in Iraq or anywhere else now. It's the civilians, in modern war especially, it's just the civilians that are so unprotected, and women and children are so unprotected, and this is definitely the case in this war. There's been what's known as the most sort of famous aspect of the war is what's called the night commuters, where upwards of 30,000 children would leave their villages at night or their home at night and go into the cities. And just sleep anywhere they could, under park benches, behind buildings, in abandoned buildings, sometimes in refugee areas or humanitarian sort of housing, just to not be abducted and not to avoid the fear of abduction at night. And you can imagine some would walk an hour and a half, 2 hours all night long to their place of sleeping, and then would have to go back in the morning to school. And some of those people did this for 2, 3, and 4 years. It still goes on. Right now, they're in some sort of peace negotiations that have just recently come to the brink of collapsing again. And when that happens, quite often violence flares up again. But these two groups, again, have been battling. And basically, one has been completely terroristic and abusive against the people of Acholi. The children suffer. And the other one has not protected these children, also had their own human rights problems against the people as well. So it's a very apt description, I think, of what's going on there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a classic case of a scenario where there's really no good guys in a way, just two sets of aggressors. And what's really heartbreaking is that the children are not only victims; they themselves are turned into aggressors. They're turned into terrorists.
Yeah, one can only wonder what the long-term effects are. The rehabilitation processes are minimal. The money for rehabilitation for the kids when they come out of the Lord's Resistance Army is minimal. And it's an interesting country because in the South, the problem in the North is not very well known, and the South is much safer, and so it's this divide, this ongoing divide that's happened, and then people of the North have been neglected heavily, and there's no great guys, that's for sure, and they just get caught, and I can't imagine the vulnerability of those people, always caught in between trying to get peace, and then they have to try to reconcile, when the kids come back, and for the war to end, they have to, what do they do with the top five commanders of the LRA have been all indicted by the ICC, the International Criminal Court, for crimes against humanity. So There's this incredible tension of how do you reconcile and forgive, and they have these rituals for that, but they push the possibility of those kind of things to extremes, and you have the ICC involved, you have the UN involved, whether the UN should go in or not, as a peacekeeping force, you have the Acholi elders trying to do what they have to do, you have the politics of the government playing their role in their games, and then you have the LRA movement, the Lord's Resistance Army movement in there, and they're caught between all these forces. They're caught by the past, the colonial past. They're caught by the ravages of post-Idi Amin and civil war, and they're caught by between all these different variables, one can only look at history and see that things do actually change and can get better. We also know they can get worse at different times, but at least One can't give up, and the spirit of those children really exemplify that hope.
Well, the story is a universal story in so many ways, as you said, and one of them is this very dynamic that you're talking about is you know, do you bring people to justice and punish them for your crimes, or do you forgive them and reintegrate them into society? And this is something that Uganda has to deal with when an amnesty is passed, as it has been, in which rebels who have just done crimes that are unimaginable probably to every person listening to this show right now, you know, the society has to deal with that question. It's very, very difficult and very interesting, I think, and important for us to contemplate ourselves.
Well, I think in the film it's very interesting to watch because we really see the, like, no matter what the, we live in a world where we hear the sort of these abstract news ideas from, whether they're from Africa or even in our own world, that tell us what's being imposed, what ideas being imposed, and we get hopeful. We hope, okay, they're going to forgive everybody or it's amnesty for everybody. But people are individuals, and how an individual responds to any kind of abuse is of course, very individual. And so no matter what we hear, there are so many difficulties inherent in what's happening. And so I think in any of these situations, it's never going to be a clean answer, and the response is never going to be exactly, you can't actually figure it out from some sort of formulaic point of view. There's always going to be problems, and you have to have a certain amount of justice, and you have to have a certain amount of forgiveness. And so on. And but as one of the guys said in the film, Lloyd Axworthy, who had a lot to do with inspiring the film in the first place, actually, a former political leader in Canada, he said, nobody has a formula for this. And this is the truth. And of course, these things are ongoing, and they're not static. And like our own lives, they one has to remain vigilant towards, hopefully, towards love, and hopefully towards sisterhood and brotherhood. But this is, very variable. The variables of this are great. So it's fascinating to me, and challenging, and heartbreaking, and hopeful.
Well, one of the notable things about Uganda is that it's so neglected. I mean, when we hear the news, we rarely hear about Uganda. We hear about Darfur. We hear about Baghdad. We hear about Afghanistan. If people, and I mean, I think people should see the film just simply to inform themselves about what's going on there. But what if public consciousness were greater about Uganda? How do you think things could shift politically?
Well, that's a fantastic question, and it brings up all kinds of other questions about why the light is shone on certain areas and not the other areas. And of course, some of those reasons are simple matters of economics, whether the country is important or not, or whether the leader is to be left alone by the West because he serves the interests of the West, or however that works. And I think the key to awareness is it does shine a light on an area, and when the light is shone on an area. Generally, if the media is fair and is pushed on that area, the person who is in charge of that area will not be as extreme. Generally speaking, it's very rare because they public response matters, and what's going to happen to their lives a leader's life becomes more precarious. Let's say so. It's so important to have the lights on there. Uganda is an interesting country in that since the 80s. President Clinton called Yoweri Museveni a new breed of African leader in the mid 80s and the 90s, and he's been very popular with Americans, with the U.S. Government, and he's been with them. So, and also Uganda is a sort of what's called a frontline state on the war on terror, just below Sudan. So also the Acholi people they actually live in Sudan as well. The Acholi people, it's another one of those a traditional boundary has been separated by colonialism between Uganda and Sudan. So that also brings up all kinds of tensions. But it is actually a frontline state on the war on terror, so that sometimes leaves a leader free to do whatever he wants within his own country because he's popular in the West. And we can see this, how this happens. We have, in Canada, 2,000 troops, I think, in Afghanistan. For whether one decides that's good or bad reasons is an individual choice, but clearly it's following the American journey in Afghanistan as support. Meanwhile, 3 to 4 million people have died in the Congo in the last 10 years, and we don't have anybody there. It speaks volumes that we barely know what's happening in the Congo. We don't know what's happening in Uganda. We know in Darfur, but what are we doing about Darfur? It's a staggering... It's painful, but we don't, and it's so easy to draw conclusions and political and historical conclusions to it. But it's incredibly complex, and But you can, I think so often you can follow the money and you can follow the resources and you'll see where the interest is lies. I think Noam Chomsky said it well with Iraq. He said, would they be there if their main export was pickles and jelly?
Right, right. Well, Noam Chomsky appears in this film.
Yeah, he does. He gives some wonderful analysis of sort of of power structures and the psychology of colonialism, which was so useful and effective to sort of sum up that the historical context, which lets us know that the thing about Uganda and what's happening, and even when we hear about these different places where people are horrific things like cutting off hands, which there's no apology for that. That's terror. It's terror, literally, and brutal. But this is the precedent for that has been for centuries. And in fact, in the Congo, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, which was before that Zaire, and before that was the Belgian Congo, hands were cut off en masse between like in the 1880s to say 1920s. As they were forcing Africans to gather more rubber for the Belgian Empire. And so it was really important for us to show historical context. So no one would leave this movie saying to them, or this film saying, why do those people keep killing each other? Why do blacks keep killing each other? That it's a human problem, that it's not a divergent from some of the behaviors that go on from all cultures and from all, and the precedent was set actually in the colonial imposition of power and degradation and control and racism and basically what was called the scramble for Africa, which was basically take whatever resources you want. This happened in the 1880s, where all of Africa was colonized except for two countries. So the context was very important.
Yeah, I mean you do a wonderful job explaining that history and sort of picking it apart so that people can understand what the historical precedents are, and I think it points out how the news is so often devoid of historical context, and it even points out the extent to which we ourselves sort of don't know our own history and where the actions that we're involved in even locally even come from.
I agree. It sure does, and I think that's such an important point, and it's so important that that people and citizens remember the ideas of solidarity and sisterhood and brotherhood and always try to educate themselves on a deeper level if they can, or find someone that knows more about it, because history is so revealing. Even though history is written by the winners, it's still incredibly revealing. You know, in 1885, when there was a big conference in Europe, because the European countries were getting mad at each other about who was going to take what from Africa, and they finally resolved that you can, whoever gets there first basically can take whatever they want. And what's interesting is not one African was represented in that situation. It was just take what you want and go down there and get it. It's an amazing thought. And then of course the abuses that went on were immense everywhere. The first genocide of the century was in southwest in German Africa, which was in Namibia, which is in the southwest corner of Africa, and the Herero people were completely decimated by the Germans, and you know it set the tone for the century in so many ways. And in Uganda there was its situation, and in the Belgian Congo was just brutal, just nearby, and Rwanda. So much of that those tensions were exacerbated during colonial rule, and even in post-colonial rule, by the leaders that were in power and by the church and so on. And so I think it's really, really important just to get your empathy higher, your compassion higher, to understand that we are linked, and this is not, it's not always just as it's in the news. It's not always just another tribal war. And it's just,
right.
It's very, there's some truth to that, and it's very far from the truth at the same time. So it was a pleasure. It was a gift for me to be able to learn more and to make a film and try to shed some light on what's going on for the Acholi people in northern Uganda, because they have been completely neglected. And for 10 years they've been stuck in camps, by the way, from the government imposed camps, in which it was ostensibly protect them, but it didn't protect them at all. Abductions by the Lord Jesus Army continued to the end, and they've lived without any access to medicine, to anything, to water. They've been fed by the World Food Program. So can you imagine 10 years of your culture? It's just decimated, and you don't learn anything, and you don't grow, and you don't work together. And men without jobs lose their sort of the gender divisions are completely damaged and so on. So violence also ensues that way, and all kinds of problems and all kinds of diseases spread through those camps much more quickly. And the Ugandan Ministry of Health a couple of years ago put out a very damning report on those camps, in which they found that many more people have died in the camps than by the LRA. So you can see the tension there. Mahmoud Bamdani, a wonderful scholar from Columbia University in New York, who also lived in Uganda and was raised in Uganda, was thrown out by both Idi Amin and another president, Milton Obote, at different times. He said this is, you know, by anyone's standards, is a crime against humanity. So,
Pete McCormick, I want to thank you so much for being with us on the telephone today and for making this film, which, you know, despite the absolute horror in it, has a great deal of heart and even hope in it.
I want to thank you for having me on and letting me talk about it, because it's an incredibly important issue.
The film is called Uganda Rising. Pete McCormick is writer and director. The documentary has won a number of awards. It screens tomorrow night at the Santa Fe Film Center at 7:45. Thanks again, Pete McCormick.
Thank you.
We're going to take a little break right now and hear a commentary from Ron Bloomberg, and we'll be talking about African rock art in just a moment. Stay tuned.
It's Ron Bloomberg, just a voice in the crowd. All right, I don't want this to go any further than, say, Taos. But sometimes at night, not every night, mind you, maybe three nights a week, four if I really need a fix, I get myself really comfortable and watch, oh, God, I don't know how to say this. I watch Antiques Roadshow. Exciting life I'm living, don't you think? I used to be a wild, exciting, adventurous guy. Oh, wait a minute. That was Robert Downey Jr. Anyhow, there I am, sitting in front of my gigantic new flat-screen, high-definition TV, watching a set of porcelain plates. Of course, the dialogue is very snappy. It belonged to my great-aunt. It was given to her by her great-aunt, and it's been in our closet for 40 years. Not my great-aunt, the plates, and I always wondered what it might be worth. The appraiser always says, well, let's turn it over and see if it's signed. Of course, the seductive part of the show is trying to guess what those objects are worth. So you say 20 years ago you bought this sewing box at a flea market for $5.35. Well, I would estimate its value today at $65,000 to $75,000. Of course, cynic that I am, I always think, okay, let's see her get $65,000 to $70,000. They never managed to show us that part. And yet, I do secretly wonder what that gold-plated harmonica that my uncle left me is worth. It's not exactly signed, but there is a marking on it. Let me see what it says. Oh, made in Taiwan. Talk to you next week, if you have a minute.
I'd like now to welcome David Coulson. He's professional photographer and co-author of the book African Rock Art, and he will be speaking tomorrow night at the Lensic at 8 o'clock, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research and the Leakey Foundation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. The book is stunning. What is rock art?
Rock art is paintings and engravings on stone, is the way we describe it. In the States, people tend to talk about petroglyphs as engravings and pictographs as paintings, but it's the same thing. And then, of course, there's etchings and everything else. But either it's paint or it's carving.
Now, this is this book, which is a very ambitious book with a great scope, is about the place where humankind was born, Africa. Is this also where we have the very first examples of art?
It certainly seems to be, although there's a lot more research that's got to be done. In terms of dating, at the moment France has the oldest art. We've got dates in the Chauvet cave of about 32,000 years. But we're not far behind in terms of carbon dating. You know, in southern Namibia in 1969, they found some paintings which were dated about 27,000. So, you know, it's quite old. And when you think that there's so much money for dating in Europe, there's none in Africa. I mean, there's really so little work has been done. I'm sure we'll have some surprises, except that there is a big difference that most of the famous Paleolithic cavings in paintings in Europe are in deep, hermetically sealed caves, so that's allowed them to survive, whereas most of the art in Africa is out there. in exposed shelters. So what is actually out there in the way of paintings is unlikely to survive much more than 10,000 years. Even that's pretty remarkable. But there are plenty of cases which we've recorded of that.
That which is quite amazing. How can a piece of rock art survive that long in the weather, exposed to the elements?
Well, I suppose classically, the places that where it survived are situations where there's a prevailing wind and it's protected from the prevailing wind. For a start, I mean, those guys were not stupid, and they've chosen those places well. The other thing, and perhaps one of the biggest things, is the ingredients that they used. I mean, had probably been handed down for thousands of years, and there's a lot of research to be done still. I mean, we know that they used blood. They used to use animal fat as a binder. You know, in Europe too, we know that, and they would use mixes. Certain mixes. I mean, I heard just the other day from a Maasai in Kenya that when he was a kid, and this is now a very distinguished sort of scientist in Kenya, and he said that they used to paint on the rocks, and he said he remembered they used to get ticks, you know, like leeches, and squeeze the blood out of the ticks, and this sort of sticky substance was actually a really important mixer and so on. And there are so many secrets like that that, of course, have gone, because there aren't many people out there still painting.
Now, this book is a massive project. You're covering the whole continent of Africa and its rock art. How did you decide to take this on?
That came about, I mean, the whole thing came about, and this is partly the reason why I'm here, more than anything else, through Mary Leakey, mother of Richard, widow of, wife of Lewis, who happened to be a friend of mine. She died in 1996. But she really got me going on this whole thing for a start, both the book and the foundation that I started. She introduced me to some of the paintings she'd studied with Lewis when she was working at Olduvai in the 1950s. And, I mean, I didn't see them then, but I saw them a bit later. And she really loved rock art and had very happy memories of times that she'd spent with her father, and, as I say, in the 50s. So she got me into it all and sort of introduced the subject to vandalism, the threats, said that she'd tried and failed, which is true, to set up a foundation like this, and asked me to do a book. I mean, this book was started because she said, let's do a book. And I said, well, if we're going to do a book, I will definitely do the Sahara. And at 83, she looked a bit pale, and she said, well, I don't think... But she was one of my founding patrons and so on. But that's really how it all happened. But the other part of the answer is that I had been exposed. I mean, I was before this a photographer and a writer, and I'd produced various books. Big books had been published internationally in Africa. And my travels to remote areas, and remote areas really was a sort of common theme, had sort of exposed me to a lot of this art. And I've become really fascinated by it. And then, as I say, I met Mary, and then things just moved from there.
Well, the art is, I mean, I was surprised. I opened this book, and, you know, like with books like this, before you read the text, you just look at the pictures. And they are stunning. I mean, the virtuosity of these works of art is incredible. Were the pieces that you documented and looked at in this book already known, already cataloged by scholars? Did you discover some of these pieces?
Yeah, we've made a lot of discoveries, although I use that word advisedly, because, you know, you never really know.
Because there's people living there who probably knew all about them.
Yeah, but for them it was probably furniture and so on, and they've even been, you know, there've been travelers who've passed and never recorded them, just except maybe with their snapshot camera, and I mean that doesn't really count. So we've very much expanded the knowledge of this art, and we've, you know, long ago became really aware of the importance of it, because Africa has, you know, was for so many years, and it still even is in some circumstances, presented as a continent without a past. And it seems ridiculous in the sort of Leakey context, but I'm not really talking about the Leakey, you know, the far, far distant past like that. I mean, I'm talking about past of the past, say, 10,000 years. I mean, and what we can tell from rock art is that Africa did have an absolutely extraordinarily rich and illustrious past, you know, incredible diversity of different cultures and so on. You know, it's evident that the art that we see must have played a major role in the evolution of art, you know, and there's also the whole issue of, you know, that it does represent some of the earliest communications of mankind. So Africa didn't have, of course, a written history as we know it, but it's got this, and it doesn't give us facts in the sense of what we're used to. It doesn't do that, but it tells us how, for example, people saw their place in the cosmos, how they, you know, saw themselves in the world. And I mean, even today, the Bushmen, they use Elan power, you know, because they you know, for certain initiation and rites of passage.
What power?
Sorry, Elan is the biggest of the African antelope, and the Elan has always been a very special antelope, imbued with special powers as far as they are concerned. You quite often find that with traditional peoples, they have the particular animals that they favor like that. And because they, I mean, the Bushmen feel very, very much a part of nature, you know, and they don't see themselves as controllers of nature. They see themselves as, yeah, as sort of as partners. And, you know, whereas we see ourselves as controlling nature, and I think this is, and it's those sort of differences that you see, and you see
that represented in the rock art.
You see that represented, and you can actually see, for example, there's one favorite picture of mine in Libya, in the Central Sahara, with a magnificent elephant who's virtually life-size, and anatomically it's superb, you know, it's just really beautiful, and confronting this elephant, right up there, sort of near its eyes, is a tiny little man who's more of a little stick man, and he's got a throwing stick, you know, and he's gonna have a go at this. But, and it's what it means to us is that it shows you how he thought of himself vis-a-vis those sort of animals. I mean, they were the giants of his world, you know. They were very, very dominant, you know. Later you see in the sort of art, and it's very great art, of the pastoral period in the Sahara, these tall, big, you know, strong people, you know, with their cattle and so on. It's a very different relationship, you know, and so on.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
We're talking to David Colson. The book is called African Rock Art, and he will be speaking at the Lensic tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. It's a free event, and I assume you'll be showing a lot of the images.
Yes, absolutely. We'll be looking at certain themes. We'll look a little bit at the age, because people are always interested to see the age of some of this art. We'll look at some of the amazingly imaginative creations, you know, sort of an archive of human thought and imagination. And we'll also look at art as great art, because we believe that, you know, African rock art, and probably rock art in general, is, you know, is great art, and it sort of stands by itself along some of the greatest art that is around. But of course, it's alien to most people. And when we talk about art, fine art, you know, we're thinking about what we know, what we feel comfortable with, you know, canaletas or something like that,
framed oil paintings.
Yes, that's right. So. And it doesn't fit into a box, therefore. It doesn't fit into the box that we see art as fitting into.
Now, is there a stylistic... I mean, you cover so many different styles and regions. Is there any kind of similarity from north to south of images that appear in the art that you've studied?
There are similarities in subject. There are some similarities in style, although not so much. There are all sorts of links, actually. We weren't at all sure what we would find about that. But, I mean, I'll give you an example. The animal that, when we're talking about animal art, that stands above all other animals in the number of times it's depicted and the beauty with which it's depicted is the giraffe. I mean, it goes across almost every culture in Africa. And clearly, those cultures, those peoples thought of the giraffe as having special powers, as being, this isn't it, this is the way we would interpret this. And we know that, for example, the Bushmen did consider it a rain animal. So, I mean, that we know because it happens to be, we've got an ethnography there, and there are people, anthropologists, who've studied the Bushmen of today. You know, we know that. And although we can't extrapolate, we suspect that the same was true all over. But whether it was the same powers, of course, we have no way of knowing. I mean, personally, I would feel pretty certain that a lot of people thought of the giraffe as a rain animal. And maybe it was because it was so tall that its head sort of came above the clouds. And I don't know. I mean, but I actually saw in the Tassili, in a remote mountain in Algeria, a wonderful giraffe, quite a little small, with small little legs, and this incredibly long neck. And the neck sort of goes through this, I'm sure, what are meant to be clouds, and emerges up above it. And there's rain, there's sort of like lines coming down from under the cloud. And it's things like that make us suspect that it may well have been something like that. So the idea was often to harness, you know, to try and harness the power of the giraffe.
Now, I guess the art can tell you what animals were in a place. In other words, giraffes do not have nearly as wide range now as they did when this was produced. So when you look at this art, does it actually tell you how the weather and the landscape and so on have changed in an area?
Absolutely. I mean, especially this, especially so in the Sahara today, obviously one of the most desolate places on Earth. But most of the art that we see was created when it was a much wetter, greener land and supported huge populations. We also see signs that in we can pick up styles of art that occur in dynastic Egypt. It's more the subject matter than the style, but sometimes it can be styles too. And what we suspect, a lot of people suspect, including some Egyptologists, is that there was like a great civilization, maybe the wrong word, but a great conglomeration of fantastic cultures in the Sahara before Egypt really came to maturity.
Now, there are people living in the areas where you find the art. Do the people who live near the rock art that you're studying, in general, consider that their tradition, their heritage?
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. What's important is that obviously that they should do in terms of the conservation of it, because the fact that a lot of the art, probably most of the art, exists in very remote areas is a very good thing often, because it's much more likely to survive from that point of view. But as against that, it's also more vulnerable, and you cannot really. There's really no way you can physically protect sites that are in remote areas. I mean, it's difficult enough to protect the ones that are not in remote areas. But I mean, ones that are right out there. What are you going to do? And what's the point in putting a cage around a site or something? You know, when you come back, you'll find the bars have gone. They've been taken by some nomad to build something, you know. I mean, and it's the way it goes. The model is actually similar to the wildlife model. I mean, I think, you know, if the communities value this heritage, then they're much more likely to, if they see it as being a benefit, and that benefit might be a spiritual benefit, but it's probably more likely today to be an economic benefit, you know, for tourism or something. And so, you know, it's a very important part of what our trust Tara is doing, is working with these communities. And if there are any existing links in terms of beliefs, traditional beliefs about the art, then we help them to sort of strengthen those, you know, because those will be under threat from Christian fundamentalism or Islamic fundamentalism or whatever else, you know, typically. Or maybe it's a question of just helping them to build a little tourism infrastructure and advise them.
It's interesting. When you have this piece of evidence, which is a rock art painting or engraving, in order to make sense of it, you need other archaeological evidence, I guess, and you also can study the people who are living there right now. Do the people who are living in those places help you actually interpret the meaning of these works of art?
Again, Sometimes, and I would say occasionally. I mean, normally not. I mean, I'll give you like two examples here, right? I mean, one example was one of our most exciting discoveries, and there's a picture in the book here, is of a couple of amazing giraffes in Niger. We think between 6,000 and 7,000 years old, their life size, they've been called one of the greatest pieces of prehistoric art in ever found. And when we went to Niger, and there's a lot of other art as well, but we've been finding more and more art there, but when we first went there, the Tuareg, who are the indigenous people, didn't really know anything about them. I mean, the art had always been there. It was like furniture for them. And they said, yeah, well, it's there, but they didn't really consider it as something to do with them. And then we actually pointed out that next to some of the images were some symbols, and that these symbols looked remarkably like their writing, their ancient writing. And they said, well, it's true, but we can't understand it. And apparently that is the case with that sort of writing. I mean, if it's more than 100 years old, they don't understand it. So what we actually were doing there was getting whatever we could in terms of beliefs and stories from the older people, getting what we could from other researchers, from other areas, and assembling a sort of a mass of knowledge, and then sort of like sensitizing or resensitizing the Tuareg in their own ancient culture. And that's really been very successful, I think, and something that's been enormously appreciated. And so what was good in that particular instance was that they already had a sort of an adventure tourism infrastructure. People come in on charter flights during the very short season, and they go out and four by four vehicles into the dunes and so on. And so they had this infrastructure so that they then could now offer a different products, tourism products, as for rock art. And in Uganda and Kenya, we have recorded a lot of sites, painting sites, which we think are between 1,000 and 4,000 years old. Some of them could be older, but about around that. We think that they were painted by people called the Twa, who are related to the Pygmies. Interestingly, they are used by some people today, and there is some oral legend from other sites that aren't used for rainmaking. And yet the people who today are using them are not descendants, from what we can tell, of the original artists. But the great thing is they have embraced the heritage. We don't know how it happened, but they have, and they use them for rainmaking. As we understand, the hunter-gatherers who they found there when they first went there 200 years ago, 400 years ago, whatever it was, also were. So that's a tremendous thing if you can find that. But it is fairly unusual.
We're talking to David Coulson. He is the author, co-author of the book African Rock Art, and will be speaking tomorrow night at the Lensic, sponsored by the School for Advanced Research and the Leakey Foundation, showing a lot of the images that we're talking about today. Of course, here in radio land, we can't show them to you through the airwaves. Let's talk about the Trust for African Rock Art, TARA, which you founded. What are some of the greatest threats to rock art today? I mean, it seems ironic that some of these pieces have lasted for millennia, and then in the course of a century, they're under so much threat.
Yeah. Well, probably the biggest single one is graffiti, I mean, which you get the world over, and it's a big problem. It tends to happen most when you get expanding urban populations, i.e. expanding into areas previously wild, and you get kids wandering around up in the rocks or whatever. But there are many different forms of graffiti, and that sort of merges into sort of sheer vandalism. We've found people in the Sahara shooting with AK-47s, using the imagery as target practice. You found sort of sometimes chemical pollution, where you get chemical rain falling and sort of seeps that destroy the paint. And there are obviously there's a lot of natural threats. The worst threat of all that we've found, and we're very, very concerned about it, is actually up in Morocco, although it exists in other parts of the continent too, but much worse in Morocco. And there, the art is being broken up and sold. It's been literally broken into pieces. If there are freestanding rocks with engravings on, they're stolen. You know, these are like middlemen, and then they're sold to collectors. We think it's partly because Morocco has got a whole network of very good roads left by the French, and you've got Gibraltar, and it's an easy thing to just pop over there, and so on. But I mean, you're talking about thousands of pieces going out. I've been shown by the police in London examples and asked to authenticate them of art from there. A friend of mine at Venice Beach was offered a piece of rock art, which I think had a price tag of about $10,000 then. It beggars the imagination, really, that people are doing that sort of thing, but they are. I sometimes think that they regard it maybe as a sort of a crop. So there's a lot of work to be done there. We're currently, I've been talking to the Moroccans, there's a Royal Institute of Berber Culture, and they are very interested in possibly hosting a conference, a theft and vandalism conference, but of course now we've got to get that funded. But I mean, it's incredibly important. I mean, that whole ancient culture there is just disappearing before our eyes. It's happening so fast.
Are there laws, not that it would necessarily help, but are there laws against that kind of art theft and vandalism?
There are laws in most of these countries. Most of them actually are left over from colonial times, and people don't even know that they're there. Other countries are beginning to, you know, make new laws. I don't know that it's really so much about laws. Although, sure, if they thought that the law was going to come after them, then it would make a difference. But there again, as far as Morocco is concerned, we've actually identified some partners to work with in the community. I think we can do something about it, but. It's so vast, and we are the only people who are responsible. We have this Pan-African vision.
So what does the Trust for African Rock Art actually do? What's your mission? What are your goals? How do you go about it?
Well, our mission is to create a global awareness, greater global awareness of the importance and the endangered state of rock art, and to monitor status and work with other organizations to ensure that it will be there for future generations. And that's more or less what we're doing. And we partner with UNESCO for Africa. We partner with national museums within countries. All these partnerships and this network is very important. You know, we've got our links with different universities, it's a slowish process, but we've come a long way, you know, in 10 years. I think Mary Leakey would be happy with our progress.
And this book is part of that whole effort.
The book is part of it. The book, you know, has been out now for a few years, and it is a very important part, because it's the only book really like it. And it does give an idea of the whole continent and the whole heritage, I think, which is very good. So I'm very grateful to the Leakey Foundation for giving me this possibility of coming over here now again. I was actually here with the book a few years ago when it came out, and we think that there is actually a lot that can be learned. I mean, I've just been in West Texas looking at some of the Pecos river art there, which is...
Well, I was going to say, there's such a visual connection to the petroglyphs that we have here in the southwest.
That's right. No, there is. There's a lot of similarities. You know, you also see a lot of these geometric petroglyphs here, and of which we get masses in Africa, and you know, it would be great to do more research on possible links between them.
Well, on that note, it is time to go. David Colson, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks very much, Marcia.
And David Colson is a professional photographer and co-author of the book African Rock Art. And once again, he will be at the Lensic tomorrow night at 8 o'clock in a lecture with images of all these, many of these pieces. It's sponsored by the School for Advanced Research and the Leakey Foundation. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are streaming on the web at ksfr.org, which is a website that also tells you the latest breaking news and all sorts of things about our radio station and its programs. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. Thanks to Tim Pemberton for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Hoedown. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, we will see you tomorrow. Ciao.